This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with the East Baton Rouge Parish District Attorney, Hiller Moore III, a busy man, and he has a story that is a bit heartening, crime and violent crime in particular, down in our community in the first 7 months of 2013. Also, the furor over the actions by the sheriff's office. Hiller Moore will comment about the arrests that were made and the reason why his staff chose not to prosecute. Also, Carlos Sam, Associate Superintendent of the East Baton Rouge Parish School System. He will be in the back half of the hour to talk about some matters involving schools in our community and the Virtual Academy. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local dial. Outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. InksterShow@WRKF.org works as well. Hiller Moore is our guest, the district attorney for East Baton Rouge Parish since 2009, elected in 2008, longtime prosecutor before that, native of New Orleans, and a man who came to school at LSU and has been here for most of the time since then and now knows this community probably better than anybody else. He sees the good, the bad, and everything in between. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Well, good to see you. You're looking good.
Trying to stay in shape.
Lost 30 pounds?
Over last year or so, but about a year ago or so, and it feels a lot better.
If I remember right, you were a wrestler at one time.
I wrestled a year or two at Brother Martin and made believe like I tried to wrestle at LSU for one semester and didn't work out.
And we're also an avid rugby player for
a little more successful at rugby than
years after you were out of school.
You're
Baton Rouge rugby.
A lot of fun. LSU rugby, Baton Rouge rugby, a lot of fun.
And people who don't know the intricacies of rugby, it is a full contact sport without pads. Some might think it's as difficult as football.
That's probably why I ran for office, because I lost a lot.
But you're out on the streets, and it doesn't hurt to be able to take care of yourself on these streets. Baton Rouge is a city with challenges, but the good news is that despite our high murder rate and high violent crime rate, it's better this year significantly than last. What's the reason?
I wish I could tell you. I think it should probably come from someone else, like Dr. Ed Shahada, or the criminologist at LSU. I think whatever I would tell you may seem to be more self-serving, but I'm told that the crime numbers are down. Generally, violent crime is down. The number that we look at, that we can judge, where you can't play with any number, there's no interpretation, are bodies on the ground. And as of this date last year, we were at 60 or 61 murders, and right now in Baton Rouge we're at 39 or 40, so we're 20 to 22 murders behind last year, and that's a significant number. And the best thing about that is not only someone hasn't died, that is, other folks, younger mm-hmm. black males have not gone to jail.
It's
a big number.
30% decline, more than 30%.
Probably more. And, January we had a large number. We had 9 in January. Just this past week we had 5. Other than that, we've been averaging around 3 per month or so. So we've been doing well. We still have a long way to go.
Well, it is progress, but we have a ways to go. But the Brave program, is that doing good things?
I believe that the only thing that we've really changed in the way we approach crime and people is the Brave effort and the street operations that the city police, the sheriff, state police are doing. I believe that all the agencies are working together more now than they ever have in the past. So we're working a little bit smarter. There's actually no new people, no new money, mm-hmm. and we're just doing things differently, and we're attacking really the group violent actions. And that's where we try to have our impact now, is in group murders or gang murders. We still have a significant drug murder problem. So right now, as of the last 2.5 years of study, the majority of the murders were gang or group-related. Second number would be the drug-related, and third was domestic violence. So we have some more ways to attack murders and crime in Baton Rouge.
297-5633 is your number. Jeremy Hill, the LSU leading rusher from a year ago, freshman from Redemptorist last year, led the team and then got in more trouble. And today he's in court. You're keeping an eye on that, I'm sure.
Yeah, today's a status conference. His lawyer apparently indicated she had trouble with her August 16th date, which was scheduled for a status conference. Judge Jackson imposed some additional sanctions on him based on his simple battery charge and plea. And so I'm assuming that the defense lawyer wants to know what's the game plan for the court on any type of revocation hearing so that she can be prepared. Obviously, we need to be prepared as well.
You know the terrain well enough to know that when an LSU football star gets in trouble, whether it's Jordan Jefferson or Jeremy Hill or anybody else, the city's captivated by that,
yes.
Rightly or wrongly, more so than people who get killed.
Yep. I have more, received more phone calls and interest, I guess, on those types of cases than I do on people that are killed day in and day out. And that's kind of frustrating that that's where people's attention are, but I can see it. Oftentimes these murders that we have, they really don't hit home to the same people that are asking me questions about LSU football, because that hits home not only here, but, you know, all over the state. And so I guess it's a bigger interest. And maybe until that murder hits at your doorstep, I guess that may not change.
You say that as a huge LSU supporter.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I love LSU and Southern. I follow the sports a lot. And, you know, put you in a really difficult position. But bottom line is you have to do what you have to do based on the facts and circumstances. Everybody has opinions on every case that there is. And we may have opinions, but we still have to base ours on the facts and the law.
And Hiller Moore is also a graduate of Southern University's Law Center, as is the mayor, who did his undergraduate work at LSU. So we've got two of the big wheels in government in Louisiana and Baton Rouge who have both LSU and Southern connections appropriately. What about last week? It was a busy week for you. I'm sure your phone was ringing incessantly over the arrests that were made regarding the unconstitutional sodomy statute.
Sure. Actually, it was the week before when I received a phone call from a advocate reporter, and he asked me if I would take a look at a affidavit of probable cause on one individual who was arrested in a park, I think at Manchac Park. And so he sent it on, and I looked at it, and I said, well, this isn't a crime because there's no compensation that was exchanged or attempted to be exchanged. And then he, I think, sent another one from the same week, so it made two different cases, and it was the same according to the probable cause. And he was at the time working on a story where 10 other individuals besides those two over a two-and-a-half-year period of time in Baton Rouge in the parish were arrested under that statute. And he provided me the names, and I looked at the names, and in all 10 cases, the various assistant DAs that I have 60, they made a decision based on the facts that they received in the case and compared to the law that there was no crime committed as there was no compensation offered or exchanged at all. So, you know, my office made the right decision on those cases. To tell you the truth, I had no idea that there was an arrest made for any crime against nature. You're talking about, at that point, 10 cases, because the two were real recent, over 2.5 years. We average about 20,000 to 25,000 cases per year. So you're talking about 50,000 to 60,000 cases with 10. And with that number, we just wouldn't see a pattern. Some of the questions, you know, which are good questions, why wouldn't an assistant DA maybe have told you, hey, I see this case, this is unconstitutional? That's hard to answer. Maybe they thought that maybe there's just a misunderstanding, but the numbers are so low that it wouldn't have been brought to the attention. Hopefully it could have been in the future, but it didn't.
Were there was there more than one assistant?
Oh, we have 60. So they're allotted randomly according to 8 different sections of the court over 2.5 years of time. And, you know, the staff changes from section to section. They moved up. So different people screened. We're talking about different deputies on just about every case. I believe some different parks. The only thing that was consistent was just the one agency that made those arrests.
Okay. 297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. And we will go to the phones in a moment. Here's a question from Robert Hogan. I think this is Professor Hogan. He says, why does your office refuse to prosecute those who appear to be the real criminals in the case, the officers who made illegal arrests?
I can understand Mr. Hogan's frustration on that, but there's obviously, you know, we thought that there was some intentional act on their part to just go out and violate a statute or just try to round up people for no reason when they have not committed a crime. Obviously, that's the case here. They did not commit a crime. But I think to the deputies on the street, they're receiving a complaint. They're not out there on their own just going to try to pick up these people. They receive a complaint from citizens. Citizens, I'm assuming, believing that it's illegal when now it's not. Deputies looking at the statute. They're not lawyers, but they're looking at the statute. And the statute's still on the books, along with maybe 6, 7, 8 other statutes. And the legislature has not touched it, which apparently now they will. But once that Supreme Court decision came up, the legislature created a new statute, and it's crime against nature by solicitation. So you have the old one on the book that is now, by case law, unconstitutional, and then the new one. You know, why they did what they did, it's hard to – it would be an individual basis, but I don't see any prosecution for that.
297-5633 for Hill or Moore. We begin with Kevin. Can you tell me?
It's Charles.
Okay, Charles on North Foster. Charles, good morning. You're on the air with Hiller Moore.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Hiller. I'm an African American male, and we're very concerned about the selective and over prosecution of African American males in particular. Just to give the district attorney an example, we had a fight here on Scenic Highway. And then there was talk about giving this person a life sentence when I remember a couple of years ago there were some city parish workers who were shot at. And I didn't hear anyone talk about giving those persons who shot at them a life sentence. And then we have selective prosecution. We had the case of Jordan Jefferson when everyone, the city police, the DA's office, holding press conferences. In the meantime, there was a killer in our community who killed a grandmother, her granddaughter, and her granddaughter's friend.
Would you respond?
I mean, I'd really need to know cases, but Jordan Jefferson, you know, we had, after the arrest was made, it was made for a second-degree battery felony. We found that it was a simple battery, not a felony charge, and we did.
And there was another player arrested,
another
too.
Player arrested. That player, we did not feel, had anything to do with it, so that player was cut loose by the grand jury. We presented that case to be as accurate as we could to grand jury, which is a cross-section of the community. Black and white, male and female, old and young, and after hearing everybody, and we're talking about 30 or so witnesses, and affidavits from others who did not appear, that we received in our office, not in the grand jury, we eventually the grand jury made their decision without us, behind closed doors, that it was a simple battery charge. He eventually pled to that charge, and there were 8 eyewitnesses to his actions, and that's why he was charged. You're also talking about Trucco Stampley, who was a murderer that was out there. That happened many, many years ago. He fought that case for a long time. It was initially a death penalty case. The victims in that case were half black and half white. The victims, after 5 years of appeals and writs and 300 motions, asked that we take the death penalty off the case and prosecute him for first-degree murder without the death penalty, which we did. The jury, which was, again, a cross-section of the community, found him guilty of that offense. Selective prosecution, you know, we receive cases from the police and sheriff's office and all the agencies, and you're absolutely correct. The vast majority are African-American defendants, but also the vast majority are African-American victims, and that's who we serve, and that is the way that it is now. And with our brave efforts, hopefully the arrest will go down, and that right now we're seeing a decline in felony arrest, an increase in misdemeanors, and with the 20 less murder victims now, hopefully you're going to see a decline in arrest for murders because you're not going to have to. But, you know, in general, surely there are more African Americans that are being arrested and charged. But at the same time, I think you have to look at the victims of those crimes.
What, about 80% of the victims are black?
Yes, sir.
80%. Hiller Moore, now in his fifth year as the district attorney for East Baton Rouge Parish, graduate of LSU and Southern. He was the valedictorian of the Southern Law Center in his graduating year. He'll be back after this timeout. 297-5633. See you in 90 seconds on WRKF. 297-5633 is your number. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF. Hiller Moore is the guest, the district attorney for East Baton Rouge Parish. He will be on the ballot next year, I presume. You will be running for re-election?
Absolutely.
Okay, so no doubt about that. And I think the DA may be making some news here as far as these people that he found out were unlawfully charged under a statute that has been ruled unconstitutional involving one park in this area, Manchac Park. What's going to happen to these people?
I forgot to mention to Professor Hogan that once we identified the 12 over the 2.5 years, this was last week, I asked my staff to start preparing expungement motions and orders, and I've contacted all the different agencies, state police, clerk of court, district attorney, sheriff, FBI, and there's a fee sometimes associated with expungements. Everyone has agreed to waive their fee, and we'll try to expedite the expungement. So we'll try to reach out either through my office or maybe Councilman Delgado to find these people if they're still in the state, if not somewhere else. And if I can't, to sign the expungement. If they're not able to sign it, I'm going to see if we're authorized to file it without a signature due to the nature of the arrest and the case law so that their record can be expunged, excuse me, whether they know that this is going on here in Baton Rouge or not. So I think that's the fair thing to do for them.
And when one gets an expungement, essentially they have a clean record.
By law, when you receive an expungement, whether it's an Article 894 where you're actually guilty of the offense but you receive the deferred adjudication, it allows you to expunge your record. To any questions that's asked to you by just about everyone except for certain boards and commissions, you can say, I was never arrested, charged, or convicted of that offense, and that's the legal answer in Louisiana.
So this is significant, and of course this statute is a felony,
yes,
right?
That's
so
correct.
We're not talking about a misdemeanor here, and it's not good usually to have a felony arrest on your record.
And that's why I think
as though it never happened.
Correct, and that's why I think that it's prudent to go down this course.
Do you think you'll be able to find all these gentlemen?
If I don't, I'm going to find a way to try to make sure that their record is expunged.
297-5633, if you'd like to talk to Hiller Moore, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. You're on with Hiller Moore.
Good morning, gentlemen. First of all, Mr. Moore, I just want to thank you as a longtime resident of Baton Rouge. Your office and the Brave Project and just the cooperation with the police and your department are I'm grateful for the work y'all are doing. But my question for you, sir, is the rapper Chris Nussie Jackson. I just wanted to ask if you know about his case or if his murder has been solved, or do you know who murdered Chris Jackson?
I may defer. I mean, your question is legitimate, and I just may defer on what I think or what I know right now about Nussie Jackson. I do believe that we have information on that, and I'm kind of drawing a blank at this point. There's a lot that's out there. I do, but Phil, if you can leave your number with the secretary or the caller, I'm sorry, the station, I can give you a call back, and I'll speak with Miss Dana Cummings, who is handling that matter, and she can give you more accurate public information that may not be confidential. So if you don't mind, I'd like to do that and give you that information within an hour or so.
Okay. 297-5633 to talk with Hiller Moore, East Baton Rouge Parish District Attorney. There's a new police chief.
Yes.
This is a significant move. Carl Dabity, do you know him well?
Absolutely. To me, we had a lot of good candidates. I wouldn't want to be the mayor to make that decision, even just from the three that were finalists, but all the others. But he's a very good. He'll be a very good chief of police.
Well, what does it take to be a good chief of police?
Somebody that can bring the morale up in the department. Somebody that's been there, knows the personnel, can identify the issues, and can delegate well. And from what I've seen over his short tenure as an interim, he has all the qualities of a good chief of police. I believe that he mails all of the qualities of the previous chiefs that we've had. And I believe he's going to be very successful, and hopefully he's going to be here for a long time.
297-5633, Larry near Cortana. You're on the air with Hiller Moore. Hi, Larry.
Thank you very much, and good morning, gentlemen.
Hello.
I'm concerned about this, Mr. Moore. Is that always believe that crime, if we could bring our areas up and what have you, in cities and whatnot, we will not have too much crime. I think people have the tendency to, especially young people, kill where they live.
I believe that you're absolutely correct. Law enforcement is really not the proper party to raise a child and teach him right from wrong. We lose it when we lose it in home, and if we can't get it in the schools, then we really, we're at a disadvantage then, and that's what we're seeing. And I agree with you. They do kill close to their home in their neighborhoods, and part of the BRAVE effort is trying to restore power to the people in the community like you to make sure that they have a voice and not afraid, and that we do the right thing. And we need more help from citizens in the community, and hopefully that's going to change. And we do see some effort right now with the faith-based and the different community organizations, but that's going to take some time. It took us about 40 or 50 years to get in the predicament we're in, and we're not going to get out of it overnight.
Now, Hiller Moore brought a veritable library with him. He's got a stack of books here. You've been doing a lot of reading. All these books are related to crime one way or the other. How have those books affected your decisions?
Well, over the last three or so years, myself and Mark Dumain, who's the CEO at the office, have read every research paper and book and document on crime reduction. And because there's so many different theories that are out there, fortunately, we stumbled across the Operation Ceasefire with Dr. David Kennedy, John Jay School of Criminal Justice in New York, and he's advocated the group violence reduction strategy, also gun violence reduction strategy, which we call BRAVE here. We were fortunate to receive that grant, and that seems to be the most successful program that has been going on. It's statistical based, and we're using LSU research right now. They're giving us a phenomenal amount of information, and we're working smarter and better rather than just working harder. It tells us where to go, what to do. It looks at people and places and times and tells you how you can affect crime in a bigger way than you can in just generally going out after 3,000 bad guys every day with 700. That number doesn't work.
A listener asks about the crime that we've had in this community post-Katrina and asks whether it's related to what happened with people coming here who were not here before.
A very good question. This is what I see. I believe that most of the bad guys that came up from Katrina have left. Fortunately, the really bad guys went to Dallas, Houston, and Atlanta. They're still suffering significant problems there. From what I see from Katrina, I hate to dump on New Orleans because
your
I'm
hometown.
One of them, but it did teach our guys how to be smarter at what they do, how to intimidate witnesses more, maybe how to kill witnesses. At the same time, it also created a pipeline from New Orleans through Baton Rouge to Dallas to Houston to Mexico to Atlanta when they've never had that pipeline before for guns and drugs and cooperation amongst folks, made it much more difficult for us.
Is that a significant issue with witnesses being fearful that they're going to be killed, as some have been?
Well, there was one particular case where five witnesses, and this was over six, 7 years ago, were killed. Now, whether they were killed as a result of being a witness or their lifestyle that they lived, bottom line is that five of the witnesses were killed. That murder was not prosecutable by the time that it came in. Are witnesses threatened? Yes. Or witnesses and victims afraid? Yes. And it's because of the previous caller. They live in the same neighborhood. They know each other. They're afraid. Houses are shot up from time to time. We try to do what we can do to protect witnesses. You can't live with them 24 hours a day. Oftentimes, our witnesses and victims are criminals themselves that are on the other end of the stick, and getting them to come to court and getting them to testify is very, very difficult. That's a very big chore and challenge for us. You'll see oftentimes that we put our own witnesses in jail on a Friday when we hold a status conference for the trial to be scheduled on Monday, and they don't appear. When they don't appear on Friday, or they're not taking your calls anymore, it's a good indication they're not coming. And when you have a jury sitting there ready to go and your witness isn't there, judges get frustrated. You can't prove your case. A murderer may walk. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult.
Well, you were a prosecutor for many years. You still are the main prosecutor, but you were out on the streets. Do your people, do they feel like they're in any danger?
Absolutely. I mean, whether it's perceived or not, it's real to them. And people are afraid to come forward. And that's one of the challenges that we have. We have to make sure that the community takes back its own community. And let's not be afraid again. Call us if you see something. Call us if you're fearful. And we're going to do what we can do to help you. We do take people and we put them up. We can move you from here to another city. We can put you in hotels. Nobody wants to move, especially when you have children, you have school. It makes it real difficult.
Cleve asked about the little Boosie acquittal. Was that a setback?
You know, that's justice. And I, just like I take juries that return verdicts that are guilty, I accept what the jury returns based on the evidence. As you know, our witness that gave us all of the information, Michael Loudon, he all the way up to the day of his testimony indicated he was going to say what he had told us and which we had corroborated forever. And when he took the stand, he denied everything that he had said, and the jury made their decision based on the evidence that they had. I don't fault that jury at all. Do I believe that the evidence was there to convict? Yes, but that's justice, and the jury needs to make sure that they are 100% sure that that person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I do not fault the jury at all. I commend the work that the different departments did. They worked very hard, and as you know, Marlo Mike was tried not long ago and was convicted very quickly of second-degree murder.
And it is suspected that he may have participated in other murders.
Probably about six, I believe, is what
he was arrested for. And he was how old when this was going on?
16, 17, 18, and this was in South Baton Rouge. And it was a significant impact on murders in Baton Rouge at that time.
And 16, 17, 18, he's essentially, if everything is correct, a gun for hire.
Well, the testimony was clear that he was a gun for hire, and even even his own words and his statements and tattoos that he had on his body indicated it was a gun for he was a gun for hire. Also, other witnesses that corroborated his testimony testified to the same.
Now, little Boosie, he's still in jail, isn't he?
To my understanding, yes.
On another
unrelated offense. Drug charge.
But the streets out there, are they safer now? You've got the numbers showing that things are better, but are there certain areas of the city that you would caution people to hang out in?
Yeah, I mean, look around and look at the numbers in certain parts of 70805 for sure. But when you go to 05, those vast majority of those people there want to live in peace, and they do. And it's like a 3-square-mile block if you take 70805, and that's where everything's occurring. And when you look at the numbers of people that are returning from prison, the parolees, the juvenile detainees that are returning from juvenile detention, the majority are going to 05. So that area is hit real hard economically with no stores, no business. So it's very difficult. Certain parts of 70802, down at the bottoms, as they call it, by LSU, some areas of Glen Oaks, although Glen Oaks has been reasonably quiet, some areas in Scotlandville, and then parts of Gardeer. I think the sheriff has done a very good job in Gardeer of really stepping up enforcement there. But different areas of the city need help, and we need help not only in police protection but economic development and education, to me, is key to everything.
Do you need more prosecutors, more people on the streets?
Yes, I believe that we can benefit from more people on the street. But every time you put an officer on the street, there's a new academy. If you release 30 officers, you average 400 new arrests a year. That really adds to us. And now when you look at Katrina, Baton Rouge is the biggest city in the state. We have, by law, 45 spots that are paid by the legislature. We have around 60 ADA, so we have to pay for the rest of those. New Orleans has 90. Jefferson Parish has 70 or more.
And you have how many?
We have 45 spots paid by the state. So we are really behind the curve. And asking the legislature for more money for more people is very difficult. We've held off the last 4 years. We'll do our best to hold off again to see if we can make it without that. But surely we could use more help. Right now, I'd like to see more help for the departments and us with technology, cell phone technology, all the different information sites that are out there, Facebook. You saw a Backpage article. cell phone tower information, computers. That's where everything is. Everything's held and captured on murder cases on someone's cell phone by a phone call or by a text or by triangulation of cell phone towers. And, you know, someone our age, it's kind of difficult to jump into that. And so we'd like to have a lot more training of the officers to where they can turn that information around very quickly.
How has DNA evidence changed the
DNA
landscape?
Evidence is television. And if you don't have DNA, or if you don't have an explanation why you don't have DNA, the jury wants to know where is it and why didn't you show it to me. Mm-hmm. Just like fingerprints used to be, now it's all DNA. And we generally have a DNA expert in every case that we have, whether it has DNA or not.
Well, it's changed the landscape, and some people who were wrongly convicted have been set free.
Absolutely. And the turnaround time now for DNA is within a week, whereas it used to be months. Mm-hmm. The crime lab has done a phenomenal job, and a lot of credit goes to the commander of the state police.
How far back is that evidence kept?
Well, if you recall, we've had several rape cases that are 20 to 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That were kept in the refrigerator, taken out during the hurricanes when we lost power, restored to other safe areas. We had a murder that was 20 years old, Tina Kristinek's murder. That DNA linked that person, mm-hmm. and that person was in jail serving a murder sentence in Georgia. So all of that backlog has now been cleared. And so the latest I know is around 25 years.
Okay. Ashley says she was moved by your remarks at the funeral of Wilbur Jordan, the attorney. Who died?
Man, you talk about a good man that always had a smile on his face. Just a really good fella, and I guarantee his wife, Miss Ruby, misses him. She's a truancy officer, works very hard to try to help these kids, and he's done a lot to try to help young kids that are down and out. And we need a whole lot more people like him.
Well, getting back to the topic that has caught most of the attention over the last few weeks. Your office obviously will not prosecute anybody under this sodomy statute, and there's no evidence that you did.
Yeah, none under the old unconstitutional one. Now, if there's one that's payment that makes it a crime, then
well, the legislature may or may not do something, but right now there's nothing on the books that would constitute a crime on what occurred with these 10 men that you...
Correct, with
about.
These 12, actually.
There's 12?
Men, that's
12?
Correct.
Okay.
And no, they would never...
There were
12
of them. And you say you're trying to find all 12, and you will expunge their records.
If not, if I can't find them, I'm going to see if I'm allowed by law to file an expungement without their signature.
Well, it shouldn't be that difficult to find them, should it?
Well, it depends if they live here or not anymore. But
you have their names, probably their social security numbers.
I do.
So you should be able to find them. And these men could file suit against the sheriff's office, but John Delgado said that's unlikely because they don't want to be subjected to humiliation.
Yeah, and if anyone out there is one of the 12 and they wish to sign
contact
that order,
your office,
all they have to do is they can contact my office and ask for me, and we'll make sure they're handled discreetly.
All right, what's best number?
389-3402.
Hiller Moore, a straight shooter and a man who's at the front lines of crime in Baton Rouge and making our community a better place. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with Carlos Sam, the associate superintendent in East Baton Rouge Parish's school system, after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're joined now by the associate superintendent in the East Baton Rouge Parish school system, Carlos Sam. Good morning, Dr. Sam.
Good morning, Jim. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, and we have a few matters to discuss with you. It's an interesting time in our community. We just heard about crime, but what are the education initiatives that seem to be working or not?
Well, we have some very exciting education initiatives in the East Baton Rouge Parish school system, particularly for the 13-14 school year. We're launching a virtual learning academy for those students who want to basically take a different route in terms of how they access educational services. And so students who may want to take more online courses can call us at 922-5645. This is a virtual academy that we would consider to be for those self-motivated, independent learners can take courses online and at home virtually.
Well, when you say virtually, how does that work?
Well, there will be some requirements for students to come to the brick-and-mortar location, but 70% to 80% of the educational services will be delivered by way of online courses. So students who have access to Internet and a computer at home or elsewhere will not be required to attend school, 5 days a week, starting at, 7:10 in the morning. So basically the curriculum will be accessible 24/7.
Is there a deadline of some sort?
Well, the normal deadline to register, of course, we understand that because we're launching it, for the first time, we have some flexibility of getting students enrolled. So basically, there's no deadline per se, but we want to encourage folks to get started for August 12th like all the other students are starting.
August 12th, so
August 12th.
We're a week away.
We're a week away, absolutely. So in other words, you are enrolled as an East Baton Rouge Parish School student, as policy would dictate. So you're a full-time student with full-time courses, and you can access elective courses online. But let me say this, Jim. If for some reason a student wants to be a part-time virtual student, we're also allowing that model as well. So a student wants to take some courses online at home and also want to access courses at school and can provide their own transportation to school, we're allowing students to do that as well. And if they want to take extracurricular activities or participate in extracurricular activities like clubs or the track team or whatnot, they can also participate in extracurricular activities at the school site.
Carlos Sam is our guest. He's the associate superintendent of the East Baton Rouge Parish School System. He's held that job now for a year and about 4 months. He serves on the board of directors for the Louisiana Teachers Retirement System as well and the Recreation and Parks Commission for the Parish of East Baton Rouge. He is a busy man, and he's involved in the Office of School Leadership and Instruction. This virtual academy, how is the quality of instruction? Is it on a par with what happens in a traditional environment?
It's on a par with what would happen in a traditional environment. We're using a vendor called Edgenuity, which is formerly known as E2020. E2020 is a platform that many of the surrounding school districts use for their online courses in particular. I know Lafayette Parish and many others that use Edgenuity. So it is standard-based. It's aligned to the Common Core. And we're having a big parent meeting, actually, Jim, tomorrow night at 6 o'clock p.m. here at the school board office for any interested parents who want to learn more about the Virtual Learning Academy, 6 o'clock tomorrow night.
And it's held where, Carlos?
At the East Baton Rouge Parish School Board.
Okay, so tomorrow, 6 o'clock, you'll have a chance to find out more about the Virtual Academy. And as far as education in general, are things getting better?
Well, things are getting a whole lot better. And let me tell you why. Just recently, we got notice from the Louisiana Department of Education that we have more schools who are performing at the unacceptable level. So we actually have 12 less schools in comparison to last school year that are performing at the unacceptable level. Those schools are now considered out of AUS. And so we're very proud of that. We're now a C district, and so performance growth has continued to rise over the last 5 to 7 years in the East Baton Rouge Parish School System. So, as I would say, the vital signs of the district indicate a positive move forward.
When you say a C district, that means like a C grade, right?
That means like a C grade. So under the state accountability system, districts are given a grade at A to F, and we're now a C district and hopefully moving closer to that A mark.
Last year was A?
Last year we were a D district, and so we've made significant gains over the last, I'd say, 2 school years to put us at that C mark, and we're just moving forward. We have a lot of new administrators this school year, young, energetic administrators in some of our schools, and so we're providing the needed professional development mm-hmm. to support them as we come online for this school year.
What about the continued push for another breakaway school district?
Well, fortunately, we were successful in defeating that bill, and that's something that you know, we may have to encounter for next school year. But in the meantime, we're kind of just focusing on, you know, improving student achievement for all students, making sure we are in line with the Common Core standards and provide the needed support to teachers and principals as we bring on Common Core. As some of the stakeholders may know, next spring will be the first year that we'll be tested on the Common Core using the PARC assessments. And so Louisiana has adopted the PARC assessments. So we really have to take a close look at making sure that our curriculum is tight, that students, teachers are staying on pace in terms of the standards, and students are coming to school every day ready to learn. We had a big expo this past Saturday in the Mall of Cartana, and so that was a very successful event, trying to get as much information out about the school year and about the curriculum and transportation and food service and that kind of thing. So we extend ourselves out to the community, making sure that parents and others understand what it's going to take to keep our kids you know, in line with Common Core.
Carlos Sam is with us, 297-5633, if you'd like to join us in our remaining moments with Carlos, who he is the associate superintendent and head of the school leadership and instruction operation at the superintendent's office. Tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, there will be a meeting involving the Virtual Academy, and it's at your central office, right?
That's correct.
1050 South Foster Drive.
Yes, sir.
Is the place to go, 1050 South Foster. You speak from experience. You were a teacher in the East Baton Rouge Parish school system, as well as a principal, a director of magnet schools, and where you also were interim superintendent. You have a background that is such that I would imagine you know the landscape quite intricately.
Well, I've been fortunate, Jim, to have served the school district for 25 years and was able to move from the teacher level up to the current level. And so I've just been fortunate and blessed to have the experience to learn under many prominent and great leaders, principals and central office staff and superintendents. And so I'm just fortunate to have gained the experience that I've gained over time.
How has the environment changed for teachers in 25 years from when you first began?
Wow, yeah. Yeah, well, accountability has brought about a different level of anxiety for some teachers. Not all bad, not all good, but it definitely has changed from my time in the classroom. But, you know, change is not always bad. Change sometimes bring about change that's for the positive. You know, my philosophy is, you know, I don't like the changes for the sake of change, but accountability has definitely brought about change in terms of, in particular, the COMPAS evaluation for teachers that was instituted, in, I guess, close to 12, 14 months ago. That particular instrument that the state adopted really takes a close look at the degree of instruction that's taking place in the classroom. But it really takes a closer look at what students are actually doing in the classroom more than what teachers are doing. You know, what kinds of discussions students are having, what kind of work they're working on, the level of the questioning techniques in the classroom. So those are the kinds of changes that I've seen over the years.
297-5633. Sarah asks, what kinds of courses will be offered under this Virtual Academy concept?
Just about any kind of course you can imagine, Jim. Of course, all the core courses, when I say core, meaning English, math, science, social studies, including foreign language courses, French and Spanish. We also have an array of elective courses that are offered around engineering, around technology. There's just a variety of courses. We don't have the same level of offerings that we would have in the brick-and-mortar location, but we think we have a large variety enough that would intrigue, you know, parents and students to want to take a good close look at the Virtual Learning Academy.
Well, you have a tough job as far as these grades, and you said Baton Rouge now has a C grade as far as its school evaluation. How much stock do you put in this?
How much thought?
How much stock? How much relevance does this really have?
Well, I think it has a lot of relevance, Jim. I mean, when you compare our student body to, you know, surrounding student bodies around the state. I think our students are competing quite well with other students, you know, in the regional area. And so as you really take a close look at comparison of student to student, I think they're doing quite well. And so, but all that hard work really goes back to the classroom. So the folks that are really, you know, where the rubber meets the road is in the classroom with teachers and principals, and those folks are in the buildings day to day, that's really putting in the grind to making sure that students are moving in the right direction. We do a lot of work around progress monitoring, meaning that we're really watching students on a daily and weekly basis, making sure that they're moving students daily. And so that's one of the reasons why we're showing the progress that we're showing.
Do you like teacher evaluations?
I think evaluations are needed in any profession. Regardless of what kind of work you're doing, there's no way that you can get around it to be able to demonstrate that you're showing some level of progress or improvement. So, you know, evaluation is just part of life. I think we evaluate ourselves on a personal level as well. So, you know, evaluation just has to be part of the job.
Carlos Sam is the Associate Superintendent of the East Baton Rouge Parish School System, longtime veteran of the system, and as he stated, tomorrow night, 6 o'clock at the central office, 1050 South Foster, there will be a meeting, and you may attend and find out more about the virtual academy. And phone number is 225-922-5416 for the office, 225-922-5416. Do you have anything to add that we may have missed, Carlos?
No, Jim, I just want to thank you and your staff for having me on this morning. We appreciate the opportunity to be able to share all the good things that are going on in the East Baton Rouge Parish school system.
Well, thank you, and let's stay in touch.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too. Thanks. And tomorrow, one of our guests is slated to be Rob Manis, the third candidate in the U.S. Senate race next year as Mary Landrieu seeks a fourth term against Bill Cassidy, a Republican congressman from Baton Rouge. And Rob Manis is a Tea Party candidate. And John McGinnis on this show said that Mr. Manis could very well force a runoff that would be in December, and it would really be something if the U.S. Senate control were in the balance, with Louisiana holding the last election in 2014. And there likely will be other candidates in that race, and some are not ruling out a late entry by Governor Bobby Jindal. One of the big stories this year in our community, it was the purchase of the Baton Rouge Advocate by John Georges, the New Orleans businessman, and it was never revealed what it cost Mr. Georges to acquire the Advocate, but some have said, including the debt, that it may be in the ballpark of $50 million. Well, yesterday, in a staggering move as far as a reduction in cost, John Henry, the owner of the Boston Red Sox, purchased the Boston Globe and the Worcester Telegram and Gazette and other properties from the New York Times Company, including the building that the Boston Globe is in, which has immense value. All of this for $70 million in cash. $70 million. Boston Globe by itself has 369,000 subscribers on Sundays, so it is still a big newspaper, but what is most startling about this is that these transactions, the acquisition of the Boston Globe alone in 1993 by the New York Times, was for $1.1 billion. That's with a B. $300 million for the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. So the New York Times gave up a $1.4 billion investment for $70 million. So that's about 5% of the original value 20 years ago, which says a lot about the state of newspapers in America, and also emphasizes the bravery of John Georges to step in and spend huge money, estimated at $50 million, to acquire the Baton Rouge Advocate, which has about one quarter of the subscribers as the Boston Globe. So Mr. Georges is a brave man and charting terrain that is uncertain at best, but he has stepped in with vigor, and we will see how it goes. But the New York Times, amazingly, it was the most expensive acquisition of a newspaper ever, $1.1 billion 20 years ago, sold for $70 million to the owner of the Boston Red Sox, not a publisher, a guy who owns a baseball team and has some other business investments, John W. Henry. John Henry. Until tomorrow, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.